From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Way before the sun is up and most of Los Angeles has opened its eyes, Roxana Julepot flips on the lights and turns on the ovens of Friends and Family, the restaurant and bakery she owns with her husband in East Hollywood. By the time the doors open at 8 a.m., the pastry case is glowing with baked goods alive with the colors and textures of whole grains. A longtime advocate of the modern grain movement, Roxana compiled recipes, some of which you'll recognize behind that glass, into a cookbook that many of us have been waiting for a long time. It's called Mother Grains. Hi, Roxana.
Hi, Evan.
Well, this book was worth the wait. You have such a clear, strong voice.
Oh, thank you.
You were an early advocate of the local grain movement. Did you have an aha moment that really plugged you into it?
I feel like probably the most clear revelation for me was gaining an understanding that grains are also seasonal. And as you know, because we've known each other for a long time, we, my husband and I, and like the school of cooks from which I stem from, it's a firm believer in seasonality. You know, we're in California. We cannot escape it. It's all around us. So it was just a matter of connecting that missing dot.
I know that you took some time to travel around and visit farms, and you went up to the Washington Bread Lab, which is sort of a famed place of pilgrimage for bakers who want to use grains from their local food sheds. Can you share what those experiences were like for you to push you in this direction?
It's interesting, the approach to grains that we have here in America versus the approach to grains that other cultures and other countries have to grain. Here, it's kind of like something we discovered, you know, or rediscovered. Like it just occurred to us that maybe we should reconsider this whole like commodity flour model and study all this ancient grains and like ancient varieties and bring them to modern times and help them acclimate to new microclimates and an ever-changing world and how to best utilize them in a modern context, right? But then the most interesting travel I did was right before we opened Friends and Family. I had the opportunity to go back home to Costa Rica where I had grown up. And then also I spent some time in Turkey. I went to Bhutan. Eventually, I ended up in Scandinavia. But what I was really enriching to me was to sort of like not look at grains as something to be rescued or something that was necessarily new, but something that is already part of us and the fabric of who we are. And we just have to reconnect with it. So as you know, growing up as a Latin American kid, I was thoroughly exposed to corn, and I always had access to vocabulary that explained to me that there were more grains than just this wheat that we use for everything, that is highly refined and grown in, at a very industrial scale. So it was really, really cool for me to see the ease with which other people, other cultures, other countries, other cooks, other bakers just treated grain without kind of like sort of like having to write a treaty about it.
So in your book, Mother Grains, you concentrate on eight grains: barley, buckwheat, corn, oats, rye, rice, sorghum, and wheat. Why these particular grains?
Well, first, they are all what we call ancient grains, right? We know this because we can trace them genetically and trace how old they actually are. But we also know that they have played a vital role in domestic agriculture. They're of a tremendous historical importance for their contributions as economical, cultural, and even political catalysts in different regions of the country and also through different time periods in the country.
So in your recipes in the book, do you use any white flour, any what we would think of as all-purpose flour?
Indeed, I do. And let me just start by saying that I dream of a day when we can all bake with 100% whole grain flours. However, I think of refined flours as a tool and use them as such. But for flavor and texture, the whole grain flour has to be central. So the only reason why white flour in minimal amounts is in the book is to sort of like fill in wherever the whole grain flour might come short. Depending on the grain, it can be things like lack of gluten, a grated texture. Sometimes you can have a bitter flavor of a starchy aftertaste. So that's the role of the refined all-purpose flour or even refined bread flour. It just comes in as a building block while the whole grain flour is there to be the assertive and identifying note of the baked good.
I want to talk about your buckwheat pancake. And every time I've eaten it or your variation made with corn, I always thought it was genius. Truly a cake made in a pan.
Sure. That's exactly right. That was the intention. So, you know, but I feel like I have a very warm spot in my heart for buckwheat. And buckwheat always makes me want to create things that are super comfort foody. So what is more comfort food than a pancake, right? What I like about doing just a big, badass pancake is that you can actually just make one as opposed to a huge stack, right? And the secret to make this pancake work is that you start in a cast iron pan and you pour the batter on the stove. So you start by making this nice sort of like crispy edge. And then you finish it in a hot oven. And that just allows the pancake to actually become cake, so to speak. So it's going to have that oven spring that we aspired to when we're making a cake, right? So you get the best of both worlds, that crispy edge and then cakey dreaminess inside.
7 of the 8 mother grains can be used in your chocolate chip cookie recipe. Can you sort of riff on the properties that each of the flours impart to the cookie and then what your preference is?
So I think I was thinking as I was writing the cookbook, I knew I was going to have to do this. I was going to have to tell people because people were going to ask me, right? And they do, and they still do, and they do it all the time. How can you substitute one flour for another? And how do you know which flour is appropriate for which use, right? And I always have this saying that, you know, you can use whichever flour you want, wherever you want, as long as you know what the flour is capable of, right? Because if you know that, for example, buckwheat has no wheat, you'll know that you'll have to like match it up with a flour that is glutinous, right? But that is like really easy for me to say and really easy for me to understand because I bake. I bake every day. So I knew I was going to have to do a recipe in which you could use all of these flours or a great variety of flours and that they were going to yield results that were very similar or that you would have a delicious result no matter what the flour was, even if the resulting cookies were each unique and special in their own way, right? So I don't know. Don't ask me to choose a favorite one because it's like choosing a favorite child. And it's interesting. This is the effect across the board. When we were testing these recipes, each one of the bakers has a favorite one and not two bakers pick the same one. So let's start with barley. So barley is a very special flour. It's very, very low in gluten. And to me, like, I mean, categorically, it represents fall, fall flavors, spice, warm notes, 100%. So the cookie that it produces is a little butterscotch, not a little, quite a bit butterscotchy, very, very brown sugary. It also has a really nice texture because that's what barley flour is. It's a very tender flour. I really, really like the buckwheat chocolate chip cookie. There's definitely an incredible affinity between the darker grains such as rye and buckwheat and chocolate. So I find this cookie to be a little bit sober, a little bit more adult, and absolutely delicious. It's also terrific with just like a black cup of coffee. The oatmeal chocolate chip cookie is super playful. It will taste a little bit lighter, but it has it also have like that chew that oats will impart in a recipe. It makes a terrific ice cream sandwich. The rice chocolate chip cookie is a very interesting cookie because rice is very neutral. So the way it reacts when we put it in a recipe is that it adds a little bit of sweetness, but it's not sugar. It's a sweetness with a little bit more depth, but it also adds tremendous crunch to a recipe. So I like to bake them just until they're crispy on the outside, but it's still a little bit softer in the center. And that crispy edge with rice flour is like buttery magic, crunchy deliciousness in your mouth. The rye chocolate chip cookie, like I said, great affinity between rye and chocolate. It is the one version, the version that we make here at the bakery. And it is all of those things, like very elegant. And it also, like the rye flour tends to have a little tartness to it. So it balances the sweetness of the chocolate. And it's terrific with just a few flakes of sea salt on top. Then the Sonora wheat chocolate chip cookie is really great. Sonora, you know, a really awesome flour that we produce tons of here in California and the West Coast. Very sustainable, super climate friendly. So this is a winter cookie. Like nobody will object to this cookie. There's nobody will have like, interesting choice of flour kind of thought. You know, this is this will hit that spot. Like that whole house fantasy you have in your head of a chocolate chip cookie. And it's also very kids friendly. So for those of us who bake for children often, this is an excellent way to introduce them to whole grains and talk about flour and flour that grows close to them. And of course, spelt chocolate chip cookie works great. Spelt is a great flour because it's pretty user-friendly. You could almost utilize it as an all-purpose flour, one-to-one.
I cannot tell you how much fun this conversation has been. Thank you so much, Roxana, for just the way you talk about food. I mean, you use the words sober and playful to describe cookies. It's just the best.
Thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you, Evan.
That's Roxana Julepat, friend, baker, and author of the new book, Mother Grains, Recipes for the Grain Revolution. Pick up a copy next time you visit her at Friends and Family in East Hollywood, and check out her chocolate chip cookie recipe on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, we talk to the creators of the hit Netflix series, Waffles and Mochi. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. When I interview Gen X chefs, they often talk about learning to love food by watching Emeril or Julia or Jacques on TV. Our TV food heroes don't need last names, so it's fitting that the latest food TV celebrities don't have them.
Hi, I'm Waffles, and this is Mochi.
Waffles is a Yeti with a waffle for a father, and her sidekick Mochi is filled with strawberry ice cream. Together with the wise guidance of Mrs. O, aka former First Lady Michelle Obama, these intrepid puppets traverse the globe, meeting world-class chefs, expanding their food and taste vocabularies, and spreading so much joy in their wake. Jeremy Connor and Erica Thormelin are the creators of Waffles and Mochi on Netflix. Hello, Erica and Jeremy.
Hi.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's thrilling to have you here. In the spirit of full disclosure and just to share pride, I should say that Good Food's very own Julian Ferguson helped Waffles and Mochi plan their itinerary and was along for the ride.
We just said, Jillian, what do we do? And we gave it all to her. We were like, we trust you. You're the genius at this stuff.
I'm not going to disagree with you, but I'm really sorry now that everyone in the world also knows.
She's your best kept secret.
My best kept secret, for sure. So there is this old television trope of never working with kids and animals. So who first decided that a children's show was a good idea? And kind of take us through how this, the form came to be.
Well, a long, long time ago, Jeremy and I took a crack at this idea. I was obsessed with the idea of puppets in a kitchen cooking and eating. And Jeremy and some friends of ours, because we've known each other for a long, long time, we got together at a friend's mom's house, I think, and tried it out. And yeah, I think it didn't go anywhere. It went to YouTube. And folks weren't ready to see kids in a kitchen on television, right? There's a lot of potentially scary stuff. And Jeremy and I went our separate ways. We put the idea in a drawer. And then life took us on different paths. Jeremy went on to co-create Drunk History and some other projects. And I went and got my master's in education. And then we ran into one another in a restaurant in LA when I was visiting. And Jeremy had become a dad.
Yeah, I saw Erica and I couldn't get my kid to eat a tomato. You know, I ran into Erica and I said, oh, I wish that show existed now because I'd actually be able to, you know, get him to eat something. He's so picky. And so we kind of just started futzing around with this idea and thought, you know, this could be kind of cool. When we first did this, there was nothing for kids like it, but now there is 1,000 kids shows and kids chopping food and, you know, cooking. And there was no Anthony Bourdain or there was no Ugly Delicious or Salt Fat Acid Heat when we first started. So in this new world of food entertainment, we thought, oh, what if we brought that into the kids space and really went with that?
There's something so perfect about the characters of Waffles and Mochi. Waffles is so messy and curious, and Mochi is so squishy and adorable and taciturn with his meeps. Why are they so completely clueless when it comes to even the simplest food information? What's their backstory?
Well, they hail from the land of frozen food, which is this magical place, right? Originally, we loved this idea of setting them as kind of fish out of water. We wanted our characters to have a real curiosity, but very little knowledge about food. We wanted them to be kind of alien to our whole planet, right? We didn't want to specify a country that they could be from, right? We wanted them to be new to all the countries on the globe and kind of fell in love with this idea of, you know, maybe they're not from outer space. Maybe they've been lurking, you know, behind the freezer doors of our local supermarket.
Was the concept to have them discover food and flavors along with the child audience?
Yeah, that's right. We really want Waffles and Mochi to be a proxy for kids. Kids don't know food like Waffles and Mochi, right? It's new to them. It can be exciting. Sometimes it can be scary. And so through Waffles and Mochi's eyes and also their taste buds, our audience gets to experience those first flavors, those first tastes. Sometimes Waffles love something. Sometimes Mochi isn't sure about it, right? In our egg episode, he likes the taste but not the texture of several egg dishes over the course of the episode, and it takes a while for him to find the egg that's right for him. That should feel very familiar to anyone who's felt, you know, unsure about what's on their plate, you know, and whether or not they want to try it.
So, you know, I was lucky enough to have Waffles and Mochi visit me, and I quickly fell in love with them, forgetting totally that they were inanimate. I assume that happened over and over and over again with all of the non-actor guests that you had.
When we went to cook with Massimo Bottura in Italy, he was so taken with the puppets that he just started the scene without our cameras were not on yet, and we had to quickly scramble to sort of get everything rolling because he just went for it. He was so taken with them and immediately responded to them like they were these incredible, you know, visitors.
Let's talk about the rice episode, because I feel like so much in there is just the greatest highlights of why the show has just hit in such a joyful way for people. So it starts out with Michael Twitty, the renowned culinary historian, and he starts talking to them about rice history and some difficult stuff.
My rice connection goes like this. Mm-hmm. My people were the Mende people in a place called Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone means the mountain of the lion. So, a long time ago, people from Sierra Leone were brought to the United States, America, to the South, to grow rice by force. Unfortunately, my great, 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 you can imagine. That's a lot of greats. Grandmother was enslaved, which meant that she was separated from her family and her home and had to work by force for free. And why? Because she knew how to grow and process rice. So my people grew rice during slavery and after slavery. And rice was a common part of our diet and our identity.
That was definitely the most moving part of our filming experience. And it was a complicated moment in our editing process to figure out, are we going to have him talk about all of this? And we're so lucky that we have Higher Ground behind us and Netflix behind us who are supporting this, because we really think that this is some of the most important stuff we're talking about on this show. Where our food comes from is complicated, you know, and we didn't want to shy away from that.
So Michelle Obama is featured in each episode as the calmly wise Mrs. O, doling out morals and merit badges to the puppets at the end of each episode. What creative contributions did she make to the show?
She is all over our show and was engaged in the creative process early on. I know in one instance, she got really excited when we started talking about taste buds, because Jeremy and I got really excited about taste buds and early palates and how they affect, you know, everyone's experience of food. And Jeremy and I got really excited because she was going on and about her taste buds being very different than her husband's taste buds, because her taste buds grew up in the Midwest and they are mac and cheese taste buds. And, you know, President Barack Obama's taste buds, they grew up in Hawaii and Indonesia. So he's not really like a dairy file. He's, you know, he could pass on the mac and cheese. And that just got Jeremy and I really excited about this taste buds idea. And that became those animated characters that we visit in Mochi's mouth.
So let's talk for a minute just about the puppeteering challenges, which I had a little bit of experience with. These challenges and adventures that happen when you're dealing with a puppet in a kitchen. Like, there's a scene in the mushroom episode where Waffles dips her fingers into a sauce and then kind of licks her fingers. And I couldn't help but think, oh my gosh, she soiled her perfect blue fur. Or when Mochi fell into the spice, into the cumin, I think.
Yes.
And then had to just be brushed off. It's kind of adorable, but I mean, I imagine some puppeteer cringing somewhere behind the scenes.
I think there's a reason why you don't see a lot of puppets eating in the media. It's not advisable, but we had the greatest puppet team put together these puppets that could both be washed, but also we kind of made them pretty easy to replace parts of them. So you are correct. That ruined her hand when she dipped it into that food. And you can actually see a little green dye from the first take, or not green dye, but green food from the first take on her fingertip. But yeah, we had to wash those, and we had to bring around a few different backup puppets with us everywhere we went.
One of the goals Jeremy and I set out for this show was that Waffles and Mochi would be experiencing food in a very realistic way. And so unlike some of our favorite characters like the Muppet Swedish Chef or Sesame Street's Cookie Monster, who are hilarious, we really wanted to capture something that felt authentic, that Waffles and Mochi were truly cooking and truly eating food. And that was a challenge that I know Russ Walco, who puppeteers Mochi and is also just kind of this inventive genius, helped land. It took a lot of technical skill. I know Jeremy, a lot of takes as director. So yeah, it was a really fun experience navigating our way through. A lot of known unknowns and unknown unknowns, I think.
Well, thank you so much, you two. What a pleasure to sit on the couch and just put everything to the side and watch these two travel the world.
Thank you. We really couldn't thank have done you. It without you.
You were really a big part of this recipe. Thank you.
That was Jeremy Connor and Erica Thormelin, creators of Waffles and Mochi. Watch all 10 episodes on Netflix. The corner of 7th and Hill Street has seen its fair share of lumpia. If restaurant spaces have lineages, Petit Peso is a third-generation Filipino concept. After working for years for other people and their projects, Ria Barbosa opened the restaurant just 1 month into the pandemic. As she approaches her one-year anniversary, she joins us for this week's installment of In the Weeds.
My name is Ria Dolly Barbosa, and I'm the executive chef and partner of Petit Peso Restaurant in downtown Los Angeles. We are a Filipino restaurant that touches on the traditional, but, you know, veers towards the more progressive side of things as well. Petit Peso is roughly about 500 square feet. We're very small, and, you know, it's literally enough room for three people comfortably and also socially distanced inside as well. You know, we also run on just electric. We don't have gas lines or anything in the space, so it's a good challenge in terms of what we want to make and, you know, how we execute things. You know, with such a small space, we all had the idea in our heads, and it wasn't until one of my partners said it out loud. And, you know, Tiffany said, you know, getting this very small space was kind of a blessing in disguise. You know, we all certainly felt it. One of my old bosses said, you know, every square foot, you know, you have to figure out how to make it sell things. And so we certainly lucked out with the space that we got. We initially wanted to open in February. We signed the lease at our space in December, and we're very eager to open our doors in February. But that was right when talk about, you know, the pandemic and you know, things were starting to close down. We actually put off opening and even had a couple conversations on whether we should open at all. But we ultimately came to agreement where we have to at least try. And so we chose a date, April 17th, to open our doors. And we initially were set to open for breakfast and lunch. Our area used to have a lot of foot traffic with a lot of the office folks and the jewelry stores. But after the shutdown, all of that foot traffic went away. And so after observing that, we decided to switch our menu from serving breakfast and lunch to lunch to dinner. And we had to pivot and, you know, quickly create an all-day menu that would travel well, whether people were picking up their orders or if an app driver was picking up the orders. So, you know, we had to shift to lunch and dinner instead. Filipino food, to me, always meant gatherings or celebrations, and every gathering always included food of some sort, and it was always this venerable feast on the tables. Usually, you know, relatives would bring food, even if you were hosting, you know, people always brought something. And so food was a way for us to nurture and support and really take care of each other. With Petit Peso, my partners and I had in mind to have French brasserie vibes, but serve Filipino food. We call ourselves authentic, progressive, and approachable. We decided to use that because We wanted to keep one foot in tradition. You know, we certainly don't want to forget about that and where we came from and what we have experienced in our past. You know, Filipinos, for the longest time, it feels like we've been really good at adapting to our circumstances around us. And, you know, with a lot of Asian cultures, you know, you kind of want to blend in, you know, you don't really want to stir the pot. And I think that for myself anyway, and my partners, and with a lot of other younger Filipino cooks and chefs, we want to push our food forward. And while it may not look like something my mom or my grandmother made, you know, it certainly will remind you of those flavors and move us further into the future. I think we need to be able to adapt our cuisine also to our surroundings, and while maintaining the flavors that we are familiar with. So, for example, our chicken adobo dish, we braise chicken legs in the traditional soy, vinegar, black pepper, garlic, bay leaves, but I like to add a little bit of chili and coconut milk in my recipe. And in terms of presentation, we usually, when my parents would make chicken adobo, you know, they would leave the skin on, but we decided to take it off and roast it off until it was like chicken skin chicharron. And, you know, we use the chicken skins and fried garlic chips to kind of mimic the garlic that's in the braise. And we garnish the adobo on top with all the crunchy bits. And so while, you know, it doesn't exactly look like the same thing that my parents made growing up, the flavor is still there, but it's that texture that kind of makes you perk up and makes you, you know, kind of like think twice about the dish itself. If you were to come to Petit Peso, I would definitely suggest the chicken adobo is the most popular item, so definitely should try that. My personal favorite is the baboy tim, which is a slow braised pork belly with star anise and a little bit of hoisin. So it's kind of got this a little sweet side to it that's really delicious. Also, definitely have to get the lumpia. Everybody loves the lumpia. And one of the new items that I am really excited about is this Valenciana bowl. I guess you could call it the Filipino sticky rice version of paella, but we are giving it a little twist and giving it more of a salad slash grain bowl vibe. So I'm really excited about that. And then to finish off your meal, I would definitely suggest an ensamada or a strawberry mamon for a dessert.
That's Chef Rhea Barbosa. Support Rhea and her team by visiting petitpeso.com and order pickup and delivery. In a minute, we visit the wilds of Tasmania and then explore an exquisite Aussie meat pie right here in our own backyard. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. The first two words of how wild things are haute and feral. They describe Chef Annalise Gregory, a woman who apparently eats butter like cheese, walks fast, and was out of culinary school and into fine dining kitchens in France at 18. Annalise Gregory's life is like an allegory of the type of experiences and reassessments that cooks are making in response to pandemic life. Hi, Annalise.
Hi there.
The book is so wonderful. So tell us a bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? What was it like? Was there a lot of structure? Was there a lot of freedom?
Well, I'm from New Zealand originally, and I have a half Chinese and half Dutch mum. So that kind of influenced my childhood a lot, I suppose, in terms of like what we ate and how we were and things like that. I suppose I thought it was normal, but in hindsight, there was probably a lot of freedom. We kind of moved between our family's dairy farm in the middle of the North Island to, at one stage, like my mum took us out of school and we drove around Australia in a caravan for 4 years and did school of distance. So yeah, my childhood is like, I remember being in the outback and just like always barefoot and, you know, just like waking up early and being out there with kangaroos and things.
And growing up in New Zealand, do kids generally just want to get away as soon as they can and travel the world?
Definitely. I couldn't think of anything, anything other than just getting out when I was younger. It seems to be a particularly Kiwi thing as well, that there's a lot of people with that urge to just like discover and travel, maybe because we are from a tiny island at the bottom of the world as well.
And what was it in your growing up by that time in your teenage years that made you want to make that commitment?
I mean, my dad's a professional chef, which I like to think had no bearing upon my career choice, but, you know, it probably does in all honesty. And I suppose I just really enjoyed cooking and I was always like cooking at home and like baking cakes and just making things. I liked doing something with my hands. And yeah, that was kind of it. Also, maybe it was like, it was a chance to escape as well.
You were in culinary school at 15 and then quickly started living this gypsy life, working all over the place in high-end restaurants. You were in London, Sydney, New Zealand, and eventually you worked with Michel Barras in the French countryside. How did that experience change you?
They're the people that I know in a large way kind of like influenced a lot of, you know, foraging and like a more natural like sense of food and, you know, like growing your own vegetables and all these things. Like when I was there, you know, like you don't go out and buy punnets of flowers and put them on dishes and things. It's just you pick what's in nature. And if it's there, you pick it and it goes on the plate. And if it's not, because it's hyper seasonal up there too, like snow for 7 months of the year, then it's not. And the food really reflects that. Like in autumn, it looks like autumn and the colours are different. They really kind of like walk the walk and talk the talk. It's not lip service to anything. And it was just a really slow, different and like beautiful way of life. Like in the weekend, you know, we would go and like pick wild elderflowers and then, you know, make syrups and sit in a river and drink gin and tonics or like go for a hike with, you know, a cheese and a bottle of wine and like a baguette and, you know, go and nap in nature and swim in lakes and things in this, you know, place where there's a town of 800 people and there's very few other people around.
More balanced.
Yeah, much more balanced in a way. So the restaurant was still very high stress when you were there, but also there were like limits on like how much you were allowed to work. Like they wouldn't let you in the kitchen before 8 or 9 a.m. And then also I would go every morning to the garden at Michelle's house and pick, you know, for the gargoyle and pick vegetables and herbs and flowers and things. The garden was kind of almost like 50% of it for me of working there.
I know that at some point you were at a culinary conference, a food conference, and you had a very public conversation with noted Slovenian chef Ana Ros. And it had a pretty big impact on you.
Yeah, so I was back in Sydney and had opened a wine bar and then was doing a culinary conference called Gourmet Escape in the Margaret River. And they were like, oh, you're on a panel discussion with Ana Ros. And I was like, oh, God, okay, that's a bit much. And then I think we were meant to be answering questions from the public, but instead she just tore me to pieces on stage in front of them. I think it was entertaining for everyone anyway. And she was like, oh, you know, what are you thinking about doing next? And I was like, oh, I miss the countryside. Like I'm working in like inner city Sydney and it's great, but I miss like, you know, this way of life that I used to have. And I was like, I'm thinking of going back to countryside France. And then she just tore me to pieces. She was like, no, she was like, I know that you're from New Zealand, but you owe it to like, you know, your country and just people here to either go back to New Zealand or stay here and just go somewhere rural here. She was like, go and live on a mountain and just pick things and like cook with the foods that you find and like document it and just create something and do it here. She was like, you know, it's easy for you to just go back to France because like all of that already exists. She was like, it's much harder to do it where you're from.
And you listened to her. You got the opportunity to move to a 110-year-old farm in Tasmania, and you did it. And 4 years later, you're still there. Can you describe Tasmania, how wild it is, and what your relationship to that wildness is?
I suppose there's parts of Tasmania where it really feels like one of the last great wildernesses in the world, where you know, you can go places where, like, it's a free day walk into to get there, you know, where there's no roads. I live on kind of the south coast, and down there and the west, it's very grey, like steely and tough and wild. And you definitely have a sense that, like, you know, the ocean is in control, that you're not in charge and you're at its whims. But then when you go up the east coast, it's like white sand and like rust-coloured boulders and just like super, super blue, really clear water. Like, it looks like the Bahamas. I call it the cold Bahamas.
Can you describe a dish from the book that represents Tasmania for you?
Oh, probably anytime I cook with wallaby, it feels very Tasmanian to me, because I'd never cooked with wallaby before I moved to Tassie. It was an entirely new thing for me. And then I met a wallaby hunter on Bruny Island who kind of treats them like how the way that English treat game. So we'll hang them in the skins for a week and age them a bit in his cool room, and then dress them. And it's the best wallaby that I've ever had.
What does it taste like?
Probably like a cross between like hare and veal, if you can imagine that. Something along those lines. It's very lean because they're wild animals.
I'm glad you listened to Ana Ross. Thank you so much. This has been lovely.
Anytime.
Annalise Gregory lives and works in Tasmania. If you're in need of some armchair travel, check out her new book, How Wild Things Are. We watched a legion of restaurants pivot last March as the city shut down. Many Michelin restaurants found it difficult to switch gears as chefs traded in their tweezers for takeout boxes. At Gwen, Curtis Stone's restaurant and butcher shop, the already existing retail component was a saving grace, and the chicken pot pie to go became a staple and a life preserver. But Aussies have always loved their pies. With that connection and his butcher counter as inspiration, Chef Stone opened the Pie Room by Gwen as a pop-up in Beverly Hills. I asked him to explain the place of meat pie in Aussie food culture.
We eat pies left, right, and center. It literally is one of our staples, and they range in size and variety greatly, although the biggest difference, I guess, to what you would think of as a pie in the States is ours are usually filled with meat, usually beef, whether it's ground or braised or stewed. We eat a variety of different pies, much in the way that you'd eat a chicken pot pie, I guess. And, you know, the more you dig into it, I guess it's sort of our British heritage. You know, pies have been made in Scotland and the north of England for generations, and that sort of translated to a slightly different version when it moved to Australia. But yeah, it's certainly something we hang our hat on. It's a lunchtime snack if you're having a game of golf or if you're going to a sporting event, but also something that you might just warm up for dinner one night.
So are the pies meant to be eaten hot or at room temperature?
They're meant to be eaten hot. You know, you could eat one that was warm, and quite often we'll see our guests grab one and take with them and start eating it straight away. We're happy to warm it for them, of course, but some people do like to eat them more at room temperature. And then what you have with it is that's very personal. You know, you could go for a mustard or a chutney or a relish, all of which we make, or even a homemade ketchup we're doing as well. And some people prefer not to have anything with it at all. I think different pies kind of call for something slightly different. We're doing a chicken and a rabbit pie that are very light but very saucy, if you will. And then a couple of the beef pies we're doing a oxtail and cheek pie. So we literally braise the oxtail and braise the ox cheek and then combine those two meats. It's a bit of a take on a nose-to-tail pie. We even use suet in the pastry. So lots of the pastries, depending on what pie it's for, we use a different fat that, of course, we get from our butcher shop in Hollywood.
What is suet?
So, you know, if you look right back into the history of pies, of course, animal fat was what was used. So whether it was lard, beef fat, which is suet, or drippings, you know, so there's sort of a variety. Leaf lard is the fat that surrounds the organs. So it's a very pure, clean flavored fat, very desirable in pastry making back in the turn of the century. So, you know, to be able to sort of still access that kind of stuff. And when people eat our pies, they quite often say, oh my goodness, even the pastry tastes like a pie.
Is the crust that you make for the savory pies something that is similar to the kind of crusts that we make for sweet pies, or are they different? Like, do you use a hot water crust, or do you use something that's built more like what we would recognize?
No, built more the way you would, like a pie crust. And we, you know, like I say, we'll use different fats for flavor. But that same kind of idea of, you know, those little pieces of fat throughout the crust, you don't want to overmix a dough, because then, of course, you lose that flaky effect that you get. And what's happening is that butter is starting to melt, and the steam that is generated from that melting butter will actually puff that pastry ever so slightly. And that's why you want all those tiny little bits of fat throughout the flour. A good pie dough is always hard to handle, and that's by design. You want it to be sort of flaky and quite short. We will use a puff pastry on some of the tops of our pies. We even use a scone or a biscuit on the rabbit pie. So, we do different applications for different pies, but you know, it shouldn't be too rich, because of course the filling of the pie is quite rich, but it has to be just rich enough.
In this time during the pandemic, a lot of people are finding themselves living alone, not living in large groups. Are you making individual as well as large format pies?
We are. And again, like, if you sort of follow that study of where pies came from, there's a pasty, which is, it's a pastry. It has vegetables and meat inside, and it's sort of crimped on the top. It comes from Cornwall, where a lot of the tin mines were. So of course, as these workers would go off to work, they would have filthy hands because they were working down in a mine, but they'd want to carry their lunch with them. So the pasty was sort of developed so you could hold it by the crust and then not get whatever was on your hands on your lunch. You could literally hold it that way and eat from underneath. A little bit similar to a sausage roll, I guess. But, you know, of course, these days we just like the crust because it tastes good. So, you know, we're doing those little hand pies or individual pies, both sweet and savory. And then we're doing the bigger ones that sort of, you know, fit the family meal. I think the thing that's so appealing about a pie for dinner is it's everything's in there. The veggies are in there, the meat, of course, is in there, and it's all encrusted in the pastry. So it's kind of a one-shot dinner, and that's pretty cool, especially with us all being so busy right now.
Are you making sausage rolls?
We're making sausage rolls and pasties. And Amy, who's the pastry chef, Amy Taylor, who works with me, she was the genius behind a lot of the things we did at Gwen, like the stecker bread, for instance. And she just makes the most unbelievable sweet pies. So it's the truest form of a collaboration, where I bring the braise to the party and she brings the pastry, and then together we make the pies.
I think it's genius because people do love pie. Thank you so much, Curtis.
Evan, lovely to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
That was Chef Curtis Stone of Gwen Butcher Shop and Restaurant and Maud. Visit his pop-up, The Pie Room by Gwen, in the Maud space in Beverly Hills. I have to say, these are some of the best pies I've ever eaten, truly. We've got savory pies on the Market Report next. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Spring is in the air, and Jillian Ferguson is back in Santa Monica at the Farmers Market with a look at what chefs are buying this April weekend.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. It is great to be back at the market this week. I'm talking with Steph Chen of Sugar Bear Bakes, who's a regular here at the Wednesday Santa Monica Market. And Steph, you're known for these custom, very joyful cakes that you do, as well as your pies, but you're also the co-founder of the group Gather for Good. And you're here today shopping for ingredients for an upcoming fundraiser. Tell us a little bit about what Gather for Good is and what the event is that you're planning.
Great. Thanks for having me. So Gather for Good started in 2017 with a community bake sale to raise money for organizations that are doing a lot of really important work right now. And We are made really to be a vehicle for people in the food community to do good in their own communities. So we're made up of farmers and chefs and restaurant owners, and we've raised over $200,000 since 2017 of us starting. And now is the time that is no different than others, when there's a lot of really important things that are happening and the food community wants to stand together, and specifically against Asian hate and all the hate crimes that are happening, not only in California, but across the nation. And so this fundraiser will go to support that cause right now.
Your work really is incredible. So tell us what you specifically are baking for this event.
So I am making little mini ham pies, and I will sell them by the dozen. They will be savory and sweet, and there's going to be a breakfast chorizo ham pie, a cottage ham pie with like mashed potatoes and beef in it, and the proceeds will go to supporting the fundraiser.
So the chorizo that you're buying for your breakfast pie comes from Oliver at Peds and Barnett's. Tell us what it is that you like about this particular product.
So I love Oliver's pork. They have really the best pork in town, and arguably that I've ever had in my life. And most chefs will agree. And what I love about the chorizo that he sells specifically is it's just that perfect combination of spices and a little spicy, not too salty. And it's a great complement to any other ingredient.
And tell us a little bit about how you use it. Do you just crumble it up and brown it in a pan?
I will brown it in a pan first, and then from there I'll add in the onions so that it can absorb all the oils and juices from the chorizo, and then from there I'll add the rest of the ingredients like the eggs and the seasoning, and then all of that will be wrapped in a nice flaky golden crust that is made with Tehachapi Grain Project Sonora.
Steph, this all sounds delicious. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much.
That was Steph Chen. She is the woman behind Sugar Bear Bakes and the co-founder of Gather for Good. The proceeds from Gather for Good's upcoming event benefit Asian Americans Advancing Justice and Brady United, which fights to end gun violence. You can find all the details on their website or Instagram. Just search for and Gather for Good. Oliver Woolley is the owner of Peds and Barnett's, where Steph is buying her chorizo. And Oliver, the last time we talked was over a year ago. It was the start of the pandemic. I think it was actually the week that everything shut down. And it was such a tough moment for farmers. You were, of course, reeling from the restaurant shutting down, but you'd also just moved your hogs, right, to a brand new property. Yeah. It was a moment of so much change.
Yes.
So I just wanted to start by checking in and seeing how things are going now.
Well, we made it through. At the very least, we did that. Things are going pretty well, surprisingly. We sell much more direct to people now, in more ways than we did before. We put less focus on the restaurants for about a year, but now we're going more back in that direction since a lot of them are opening up. And a lot of new customers, a lot of sort of new types of restaurant sort of concepts and stuff. It's a really interesting time, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were just saying before we got on air that it really does feel like the energy is back at the farmers market. It's busier and busier every week. Now the chefs are here with their carts. You can sense that the reopening is happening.
Definitely. Yes. Today of all days, this is the day. I don't know. It feels like spring has hit right now. It just feels like everything's getting a lot better, which is a huge relief.
Yeah, it really does. So what does springtime mean on a pig farm? What happens in the spring?
Well, on our farm, we're lucky because we're in a pretty beautiful place. Our farm's covered in wildflowers at the moment. We've got about 300 acres of oak trees and flowers, basically. And so the pigs are literally like running through the flowers, eating all the flowers, digging everything up. We have tons of litters at the moment, so we're having about 60 to 80 pigs a week being born. That's a very alive moment of the year.
And everyone talks about how you have the best pork in town. Why is that? Is it the breed?
I think it's a combination of everything that we do. You know, but the breed is not super uncommon. It's just that we feed them a very uncommon feed. We make it ourselves, and we don't feed them basically anything that everybody else does. So there's no soy, there's no corn, which 99% of the pigs in the U.S. are fed. We base it more on whole non-GMO wheat and barley, We incorporate seaweed into the diet for their gut health. They eat a lot of acorns for about 4 or 5 months of the year as well, because we have all these oak trees. We're not trying to grow them quickly like most people. We're trying to let them grow slowly. They get tons of exercise, which also, I think, I'm almost positive that that increases the marbling intramuscular. So it's sort of a combination of all of these things that leads to really good pork. Mm-hmm. They're also very happy, and they lead a very stress-free life because they have tons of space, and we let them be pigs.
So cool. And then you also, your butchery is unique. You bring some cuts to market that other people don't do.
Yes. I'm really interested in cuts that they do in other parts of the world, like in Japan, France, Spain. And then we also look at cuts that you do on, like, say, like beef cattle, for instance, like skirt steak. We do that on our pork. And another one we started doing recently is the ribeye cap, which only a few people cut off of beef cattle. But it's a really beautiful, super marbled cut off the top of the rib of the on the loin. And we didn't see why you couldn't do that on pork. So we experimented and we managed to cut it properly. And now we have that one, too. I mean, it just keeps it interesting, and it seems a shame to me to just stick to doing a few things when you can really explore the possibilities.
Yeah, and you have all these sort of value-added products too, right? You have your sausages, there's bacon.
Yeah.
Steph loves the chorizo. Tell us a little bit about the spicing that you use in that chorizo.
It's like a, people would call it a Mexican chorizo, but it's actually more like one you'd find in El Salvador down there, like Central American sort of chorizo. So it's got a lot of oregano in it. It's got red wine vinegar. So it's not super spicy per se, but it's got a ton of flavor.
Well, we're just so lucky to have you here. So thank you for all that you do, Oliver.
Thank you. Thanks for coming and chatting with me.
That was Oliver Woolley of Peds and Barnett's. You can find him at the Wednesday Santa Monica, Saturday Downtown Santa Monica, and Sunday Hollywood Farmers Markets. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks go out to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Masiha, and John Mink. I'm Evan Kleiman. Keep tipping, keep masking. We're almost there. I'll be back in 1 week with an all-new episode of Good Food.